The Guardian. This Guardian podcast was made possible by Squarespace, the all-in-one website maker with Cover Pages, a new feature that expresses your ideas with a bold single-page website. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Welcome to Sow, Grow, Repeat, the podcast that gives you chapter and verse on gardening. I'm Jane Perrone, The Guardian's gardening editor, and this week's show is all about what we've been reading this year. The horticultural page turners that have kept us up late, and the practical works that have inspired us to get back out into the garden. In the studio with me is Claire Armitstead, books editor and presenter of the Guardian Books podcast. And we have Matthew Wilson, managing director and principal designer at Clifton Nurseries and regular panellist on BBC Radio 4's Gardener's Question Time, garden designer and writer Non Morris, and Christopher Woodward, director of the Garden Museum in London. And down the line from Berkshire in the UK is writer, photographer and garden designer Naomi Slade. Claire, thanks for joining us. Garden books are a particular niche of the publishing industry, but has it been a vintage year?
Well, I've just been crunching the figures, and with 2 weeks to go till Christmas, there have been 354,000 gardening books sold, which sounds a huge amount, except you can, if you remember back in the day, there were times when individuals could sell that number. It's not a fashion area in the way that crafts are a fashion area, but I think it's trogging along quite nicely.
And do you think that in this age of apps and tablets that there is still a place for the good old-fashioned gardening book? What can we get out of these books that we won't be getting out of our computers this Christmas?
I think there are several things that you get from books that you don't get from computers. And one is beautiful books. And garden photography has really come on. I was looking at a reissued 1935 book and looking and just realising how you just couldn't have the imagery, it didn't exist, the technology, to actually represent a garden. And you don't get that on apps. But the other thing it can do is, if I'm down in my allotment, and I am an amateur gardener, but if I'm down in my allotment, I want to see what pests are and I want to see what the diseases are. And it might, you know, I have patchy internet, I can't always get it on my phone. There is an actual practicality to books, which I think won't go away, which is one of the reasons why those little trusty Hessian books are never going to go out of fashion.
You're so right. And you can always tell which books are your best ones because they're the ones that are covered in thumb marks and dog-eared pages where you've really been referring to them every time. And I have to say, whatever you may say about the design of those Hessian books, they are hardy perennials of the gardening book world. Naomi, your own book, The Plant Lover's Guide to Snowdrops, came out last year and you've just finished another book manuscript. Have you had any time to get your teeth into anyone else's book this year?
Yes, I very much have. I love reading and I also like to see what everybody's getting up to. So my forthcoming book is about orchards and fruit trees. So unsurprisingly, I've taken a good look at The Book of Pears by Joan Morgan, which is beautifully illustrated by pictures by Elizabeth Dow. And it is thoroughly juicy. It covers the history of the pear across the world, its gastronomic and ornamental qualities, how it's been used in market gardening, the history of canning. And its depth is... Its appeal is its depth and its absolute comprehensiveness.
It sounds like one of those books that you're going to be going back to and back to.
Very much so. I mean, it has a practical element as well. It's not just about 19th century kings being mocked for their portly pear-like shape. It's also got 500 varieties of ancient and modern pear with tasting notes and cultivation notes, and it describes the fruit very, very well.
As the keeper of one of those pears that I think is very under-mentioned, the Jargonelle pear, I'm kind of glad to see that you get that sort of idea of the sheer scope of different pear varieties that are out there, rather than sticking to the usual three or four that we see on the supermarket shelves. Has it made you want to go and buy and plant more pear trees?
Infinitely, yes. Yes, it's wonderful. But in some way, it's the poetry of the text that makes it for me. She says things like, the pear can be so much more exceptional in its luscious texture, boudoir perfumes and richness of taste. Gold to apple, silver, it used to be said. And its peppered with these beautiful quotes that really let the enthusiasm and the expertise, but fundamentally the enthusiasm, shine through.
It sounds great. It's not a book I've come across, so I'm going to be adding that to my Christmas list. And Naomi, what's your second choice?
It's completely different. I really liked Oxford College Gardens by Tim Richardson. It's obviously about Oxford colleges, but it still knows that it's a gardening book. And it's heavy and it's richly illustrated with lovely pictures from Andrew Lawson. But it's also scholarly and well-informed. And it picks up the rich and sort of textured bizarreness of the place. It's not a college-by-college hagiography. It sort of tells you about how the university hangs together and how it doesn't, and there are lots of sort of internecine squabbles going on. And it picks up the soil types and the riverine nature of the place, which is useful if you don't know Oxford terribly well. And then it goes through the gardens, both the planting schemes and the design, but also the history of them with a kind of meaty relish. It talks about people, and they're zealous. They have human frailty. There's lots of hubris going along. And when Lord Nuffield saw the plans for the development of Nuffield College, he was hysterical. It was terrible. It was very, very un-British. He didn't like that at all. So it's kind of Oxford, its gardens as a human zoo, interesting on many, many levels.
And I imagine that as when I got my copy in the office, several people who had been to Oxford immediately wanted to look at it to see if their college was garden was in there, which was, so there's obviously some guaranteed sales in that lot.
I think so.
Christopher, moving on to you, could you tell us about your first choice?
Well, the book I began the year with is Meadowland by John Lewis Stemple, which is subtitled The Private Life of an English Field. And it's a book written by a farmer in Herefordshire. And it begins, the ice moon is already rising over Merlin's Hill as I go down to the field. And he describes this field in which he farms as a vast square stage in which I'm the last person on earth. It's the sort of field where as you step in, you breathe out. And it's a year in the life of the field, and thoughts, observations run through his mind, books, and there's a kind of crescendo in July where he decides to scythe by hand the 5-acre field, which is this epic scene which makes that silly man in Poldhut look like a sort of Playmobil figure. And as he scythes day after day, he quotes Frost, he observes nature, and it's just this, you can feel this scent and heat rising in this hot July. I think it's a bit of a classic, actually. I think I'm going to be reading this when I'm 20 years older than I am now. The other one is also got the word land in the title. It's not strictly a gardening book either. It's called Weatherland by Alexandra Harris, and it's called Writers and Artists Under English Skies, but it could be called Writers, Gardeners and Artists Under English Skies. And basically, there's a chapter in this rather astonishing book which has got my hero of the year, who is William Cowper, the 18th century poet, who's less well known than Gilbert White. He lived at Olney in Buckinghamshire. And there's the sweetest drawing of his shed. And Cowper was a depressive. His longest poem was a mock epic on the story of a sofa. And he could never quite decide whether to fill his shed with plants or with his writing desk. And he frets. But I think he's a bit of a hero of our time because he's writing in 1783, and I've just been writing this long essay about the history of nostalgia. And one thing you learn is that two things. People always think the world has changed more in their lifetime than in the previous 500 years. And they're both right and wrong because it's always changed more. And also because people have always thought the world is a pretty bad place. And when he's writing, a volcano has gone off in Iceland. There is war in many parts of the world, and he turns to his garden to face reading the evening paper, which walks up the drive, and he just writes this lovely, "Is it a time to wrangle when the props and pillars of our planet seem to fail, and nature with a dim and sickly eye to wait the close of all?" That's in 1783, and we're kind of still here, which, and Cowper's just this lovely, attractive figure. He never writes about the world beyond the garden hedge, and he's incredibly proud of his melons, as all 18th century gardeners were. And yeah, he's my gardening hero of the year. And he did most of his writing in the winter when the shed was empty of plants.
Matthew, melons actually brings me on to one of your choices, the Heirloom Harvest book. Can you tell us a bit about this very different kind of gardening book?
Yes, I think what's interesting about Heirloom Harvest by Amy Goldman is that it straddles almost two camps, one being the very lyrical, literary, because it's a beautiful essay which opens the book and describes the history of the garden and how Amy came to purchase the land and how she established her initial garden and then how it developed from there. But it is also a thing of great beauty and a very unusual book because, unlike most gardening books, which we expect to see packed full of colour, the images in this book are daguerreotypes, so effectively black and white or silvery black and white. And they shine on the page. It's a very beautiful object. But it describes this wonderful story of how she became interested in heirloom varieties or heritage varieties, old-fashioned seeds that have fallen out of favour because they've been superseded by vegetables and fruits that are more reliable in terms of yield and that keep for longer, but also, of course, don't have the flavour. And that's effectively what she is growing for, growing for flavour. And it describes that journey and what's happened along the way, and then these wonderful images that show the end product.
I was initially very shocked by opening it up, and as you say, it's black and white. And for a moment I was thinking, I'm not sure if I like this lack of colour. But once you actually started to look at those images, and I picked out the melons particularly because they are absolutely stunning. Once you start to look at those images and you appreciate the textures, you're getting something very different than you normally get from a gardening book full of photos.
I think that's right. And I think what's particularly interesting is that vegetables tend to be positioned in gardening literary terms as being this virtuous thing that you eat. And obviously the book describes the flavours and champions the heritage varieties, but it's also positioning vegetables as something of sculptural beauty that really look quite incredible. And in fact, the author is also a sculptor. She makes bronzes of some of the vegetables that she grows. And when you see them side by side, you think, oh, actually, okay, yes, that squash or melon or pumpkin is as beautiful in real life as it is when it's rendered as a bronze.
And your other choice is one book that's been mentioned over and over again when I've asked people about their book of the year. Tell us about the second choice.
Well, this is Richard Mabey's Cabaret of Plants. And anyone who has an interest in plants and British landscapes will almost certainly have come across Richard Mabey and read his books, or at least some of his books. And he's been a figure, a very important figure, actually, I think, in the last 30, 40 years, going way back to Food for Free, which effectively reignited or ignited interest in foraging for a whole new generation and is still selling regularly, even now. I love about Cabaret of Plants is that he manages to combine this incredibly precise way of describing plants and their environments with a very lyrical turn of phrase and a very beautiful way of writing. He describes going to see the Fortinghall yew in Scotland, which may or may not be the oldest living thing in Europe, and travelling through the tweed brown landscape, which is such a wonderful way of describing that landscape. But then he's really quite disappointed when he arrives at the yew because it's not quite what he imagined it to be. He knew it wouldn't be a soaring giant of a tree, but he thought that it might be rather more impressive than this sort of loosely defined number of offsets that the tree has become over the years as the centre's died out and it's become this almost like a hedgerow, effectively. He manages to take you on a journey through different plants that you wouldn't possibly have considered and to exotic locations. It's not entirely based on British plants, far from it. It travels all over the place. And as a consequence, has that wonderfully expansive aspect that we often lack in gardening books that can be a little parochial at times.
I'm about halfway through Cabaret of Plants at the moment, and I have to say, you're right, it's an absolutely wonderful book. So I'm looking for, and the yew chapter is particularly fine, and I found it so fascinating to find that this ancient plant that, as you say, defied everyone's expectations and doesn't behave in the way you expect it to behave, which is a recurring theme in the book, that plants just don't fit into the stereotypes that we give them.
I think it's an astonishing book, and I think the beauty of the writing shouldn't make people feel comfortable with it because it's a kind of seed bomb of a book. It's a very challenging book. It questions the environmental platitudes that we can easily talk ourselves into about tree planting and our relationship with nature. And there's a passage at the end about the search for the moonflower in the Amazon jungle, which is of such beauty, but is also asking... Richard Mabey's whole life has been spent almost like rustling the ripping up the pages in the establishment bookshop of life. And he wants you his whole life, and I think we have to sort of... not treat him too respectfully, and you know, not his whole life is being spent challenging us, and we have to remember that, which is to not I can't say that. How do you say anthropomorphize, Claire?
Anthropomorphize.
To not anthropomorphize plants around us.
Anthropomorphize.
Yeah, that they're just different. They're not like us. They're not different to us. They have lives of their own. And I think what this book does better than almost any book I've ever read is show the lives that plants live independently of us, because our great fear in all these books, it's the last man thing in apocalyptic literature, is actually we all know the world is going to be better off without us and the plants are going to be just fine. And it's Richard almost trying to remove himself from that position of the human spectator and to, like a bee, vanish inside the plant.
And one of the plants that will be there is samphire, marsh samphire, which he introduced me to marsh samphire with food for free. And I'm sort of absolutely delighted that he's not too grand to still refer to it.
Yes, and it's there as a chapter in the book, and he revisits his delight in that plant. And also, as Christopher describes, there's part of the DNA of the book goes all the way back to Unofficial Countryside, which was one of his less heralded books at the time. But when you read it now, A is a wonderful read because it's effectively him taking himself off to the badlands of East London, which was the only bit of countryside he had access to at the time, and discovering plants in the most extraordinary places that had escaped from gardens or that were wild plants that shouldn't necessarily be there. And that irreverence that he has, and the way in which he can present things in a way that takes you somewhere completely differently, he still has that. And I think it does very much pick up on that book and follows it right the way through. It almost feels, in a way, when I was reading the book, I was sort of thinking, gosh, I hope this isn't him signing off, because it almost feels like that. It's a distillation of everything that's gone before. But I hope very much for all of us that it's not him signing off.
And it's hopefully it's also in this age when we can all go online and go and buy old gardening books. It's something that people will read and then go and rediscover the Unofficial Countryside and his other previous works, Food for Free being the best known. I love the fact that sometimes the garden book that I'm reading this year is a garden book that's 20 years old, because you can just go and mine the internet and find these old volumes. So while it's great to have all these new books, it's nice to go back and see what you can find from the past. Non, we've already talked about one of your choices, but perhaps you have a different perspective on Heirloom Harvest, which I know was one of your picks. What did you like about that book?
Well, I loved it. I loved it for its beauty. Actually, I found it very exotic as someone coming from Britain, very comfortable with European things. When Amy writes about serving up homegrown specialities from the old country, like Tennessee red peanuts, southern giant curly mustard greens, and Beauregard sweet potatoes. I want to know more, because it's a whole new world. The other thing that Matthew didn't mention was that she is a very serious campaigner for heritage fruit and vegetables and the loss of diversity in agriculture. So there's a very powerful, serious message about that. And she actually also talks about two books that changed her life in the course of making the garden. One was Rosalind Creasy, Cooking from the Garden, which introduced her to the splendour of heirloom vegetables, their uses in cookery and edible landscaping, which she calls it. And then another book, Carey Fowler and Pat Mooney's Shattering, which is food politics and the loss of genetic diversity, which I think opened her mind to what was going on. And then she fell in love with Carey Fowler, and now they making their garden together and preserving their seeds in their refrigerator in the basement of their house. And then I think the photographs, I went off to find out more about the daguerreotype photographic process, and it is just hard graft. It's copper plates and silver, a layer which is highly polished. And it was a 14-year project taking these photographs. And I think the quality of the images is you have these clear, light-catching, translucent white currents and the gritty surface of the Tyson pear. One critic actually described the depth of the darkness as an austere sepia, which I thought was a brilliant way of describing it. And it draws you in.
I love that white currant picture. That was my absolute favourite image in the book. Just absolutely stunning photography. And I say that as somebody who normally isn't that taken by books full of photographs. I just, after my initial scepticism about the black and white, I just was totally drawn in. It was fantastic. And your second choice, is that quite photography heavy too?
Yes, there are very, very good photographs by Val Corbett, but it's Herterton House and a New Country Garden by Frank Lawley. And it's the story of a house and a wonderful garden. It's a sort of three-dimensional tapestry of a garden that Frank Lawley and his wife Marjorie have spent 40 years steadfastly creating from an acre of Northumberland and a dilapidated stone barn. And the story of the evolution of this garden is a book to be read in many different ways. So it's a rare and incredibly honest autobiography of a life that was stretched to great things by just hard work and imagination. It's an illuminating history of gardening. And it's a precious and practical guidebook or handbook which takes the reader with extraordinary thoughtfulness and generosity through every step of creation of the garden. It's a really special book. It's the ultimate slow gardening book, so it's very timely. So a lot of the things in the garden just took ages to make. There's a Romanesque arch around the front door of the house, a tiny ivy, which took 30 years for each of the ivies on either side of the front door to join up. And elsewhere in the garden, there's a situtery, which is somewhere to sit out in, which is made of yew, and it hasn't joined up yet. There's a bench at the bottom. And I walked around the garden in October with Frank Lawley, who said, oh, it's nearly there. And you'd ask him again, it's 2.5 or 3 years, he reckons, until it will join up at the top. So it's very humbling to read and inspiring.
Inspiring for those of us who are always worrying that our garden isn't finished.
Exactly, and want it instantly. And so, yeah. And it's just really interesting. It's very rare to get a dismantling of how the Frank and Marjorie Lawley were art. They went to art college and they fell accidentally into gardening as a way of expressing their creativity. And they had to work, they didn't have very much money, had to work out for themselves what is a garden. They knew about a rectangle of lawn and a border, and they knew about big country house gardens. And they just had to work out there must be something in between. And they just took themselves off hitchhiking on pilgrimages to Great Dixter and Sissinghurst and Stratford-upon-Avon, which is where they came across kind of cosy 16th century houses, which suddenly, with walled gardens and bulging, slightly chaotic hedges and warm houses, this is a house you could toast your toes in, says Frank Lawley, about Anne Hathaway's house. And they sort of started thinking, maybe this is where we could start.
Now, Claire, as books editor, I imagine that you have absolutely no time for gardening. You must be constantly turning pages. Are there any gardening books that you've read this year that have really caught your attention?
Yeah, actually, there are loads, because that's what I do in my time off, is I look at gardening books. And I actually do love the pictures. That's what I go to for. I just think that, you know, to see a picture of a really beautiful garden is just, it's balm to the soul, isn't it? But I also love history, and I think garden archaeology is a really interesting area. You said, is there anything new? Well, actually, yes, I think there is new research being done. And one of the books that I love most is a huge, great coffee table book published by Yale, and it's a natural history of English gardening from 1650 to 1800. How much more nerdy could you get? But in this period, you had things like the Little Ice Age winter of 1683, the Great Storm of 1703, and the drought summer of the volcanic eruption, which Christopher has mentioned in Alexandra Harris's Weatherland, which was the volcanic summer that produced Frankenstein. You know, it's of huge literary importance. So what I love is the way that all these things join up, and you realise that we are a creation of our past, And the literature and the gardening, the natural history are all joined up. And I think you can see that through garden archaeology books when they're good.
Wow, I really have now got a huge reading list for this Christmas holidays. Is there anything that anyone here is planning to read over the Christmas holidays that they haven't managed to get their teeth into yet? Any more books that are on your reading lists for the next few weeks?
Well, I need to finish Cabaret of Plants as well. I've also got, I think, a build-up of Robert McFarlane's, which I know they're not technically gardening books, but for me the lines are very much blurred between one and another. And I think that area is a very interesting area anyway, where the crossover comes, because it's not a line in the sand. It should be very flexible and permeable. Difference between the two, so I think they'll keep me going over Christmas.
Yes, I'm looking forward to finishing the Cabaret of Plants as well. I absolutely love the exquisite turn of phrase. It's got this pithy, wry academic quality that, I mean, I was inspired as a small child by Food for Free. I was living in the wilds of nowhere at the time, and I'd take it and I'd go out and I'd create these museums of plants and museums of edible things and go and try and identify them and, you know, have a nibble. And I really love the way that Richard maybe takes you with him. He takes you with him to look for tiny, weeny little little flowers up the in Wordsworth country. And he takes you with him looking at the Paleolithic depiction of plants. I went down to Lascaux Caves a few years ago, and obviously there's all the bison and things in the cave, or the reiteration of the cave. And it's very much about the animals. And he takes it, so when do they start actually creating plants in rock art? That's a fascinating story through that. And again, the Fortingall Yew. And then you get the Victorian Teredomania, this craze for ferns. And it's the absolute antithesis of our current, well, preferred current crazes. We have a much greater sense of conservation now. But the Victorians would leap up and they'd gallop off with their sacks and then their pickaxes, and they'd find all the things they loved and they'd dig them up vigorously and send them down to Covent Garden or into their fern houses. And when they dug them all up, they just put them on wallpaper. So I'm a big fan of Cabaret of Plants.
It sounds like we're having a Richard Mabey love in here, which is great.
So a completely different book, which is Tania Compton's new book, The Private Gardens of England, which is huge, beautifully photographed tome, and which you might feel is forbidding, which is only about a kind of garden that most of us can never have access to. But I think that it's a sort of retelling of it all. It was started off in the 1980s with the English Woman's Garden and Englishman's Garden, which were accounts of private gardens. And I think at the time, Tania Compton, who edited the book, was noted that the editor of the 1980s versions of the books thought that that was the end of the line for this kind of large scale garden project. Whereas in fact, there are many new large and wonderful gardens that have been created and nurtured in this time. And it's the personal essays by the garden makers, which are unique and of their time, and I'll be reading over Christmas. And in fact, Frank Lawley's Herterton featured in that, one of those early 1980s, the Englishman's Garden. So it's a sort of interesting cycle. In fact, and he was rather shocked to see that his garden was then viewed as a riot of colour. So when it was the photographs that had been selected for that book, and revamped his garden, had a different approach. So actually, the publication of the book affected the way the garden developed.
What I'd like to read for Christmas is a book called The Public Realm of England, with a foreword by George Osborne, because we have this. We have this position where, as Non said in Tania's amazing book, private gardens are better than they've ever been in this country. More money has been spent on making great, often incredibly ecologically, many of the great gardens in that are meadows and ecological contemporary design. And more money has been spent in the last 20 years than any time since the Edwardian age. But at the same time, through no fault of the local authorities, in the excellent borough where I work, which is Lambeth, and a very good parks department, the budget has been cut from £6 million to £2 million. it makes me quite cross because we all say and we nod when we talk about parks, but nobody does anything whatsoever. And it is heartbreaking to see these spaces, which we know from the ones that have been restored with grants from the Heritage Lottery Fund, are just abandoned, and the poor parks managers have nothing to do but take calls from angry dog walkers. It's really sad, and nobody is doing anything substantial about it.
And their value to social cohesion isn't understood. Loads of studies have been done about it in the States in particular, and studies on the value of plants in the indoor environment have been carried out by University of Exeter. There's been a lot of work done by Washington University on the power of parks and their impact on regenerating cities, and we ignore it all and cut the budget further.
I think that we should issue a book called The Colouring Book of Parks and get people to go around their local parks and colour in what they see. There you'd have it. That would combine the most lucrative leisure market with actually some ecological purpose. Yeah.
But you'll need one brown pencil soon because there won't be any flowers.
Publishers, there's a call to arms for you. There's a book for 2016. Well, that's all for this episode. Many thanks to our guests Claire Armitstead, Matthew Wilson, Non Morris, Christopher Woodward and Naomi Slade. And thanks to all of you for listening to So Grow Repeat. You can find all the details of the books we've been talking about on the So Grow Repeat page at theguardian.com/So Grow Repeat. And we won't be leaving you over the festive season. Join us next week for a Yuletide special where I'll be learning why there's more to mistletoe than Christmas kisses and finding out how to keep your real Christmas tree looking spruce right through to Twelfth Night and what to do with it when it's all over. And if you like the show, the best way of showing your appreciation is to leave us a review on iTunes or hook up with us on Facebook, search for Guardian Gardens. And on Twitter, we're at Guardian Gardens. And if you're old school, you can email us. The address is gardens@theguardian.com. See you next week. Goodbye.
The Guardian gives you great independent journalism. Squarespace gives you the power to be independent on the web. Squarespace, the sponsor of this Guardian podcast, has Google Apps integration so you can create a beautiful website and get professional email branded to your web address. Entrepreneurship has never been easier. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.